Welcome to Idaho Speaks, Idaho's conservative talk show. My name is Ed Bejarano. I created Idaho Speaks to give voters access to conservative ideas. Liberal media and progressive activists are working hard to change Idaho into the next California or New York. Please share these episodes with friends and family, and let's keep Idaho, Idaho. A portion of today's episode is brought to you by Consumer Credit Auditors, providing credit repair services for over two decades. With inflation and recession fears comes higher costs. Fixing your credit score will save you money on credit card and loan interest. Visit www.consumercreditauditors.com to learn more. Please support the companies who support Idaho Speaks.
Hello and welcome to Idaho Speaks. I'm your host, Brian. And today we're having a conversation with Brent Regan. Many in the audience know Brent. He's the chairman of the Kootenai County Republican Party. And he's had a tremendous impact in the community by really setting up the county party to give a voice to the grassroots. But today we're going to have a conversation with Brent about the bigger picture. What are his views of politics at the national level and at the state level? And he's going to share with us his vision for what the state of Idaho could be if its full potential could be unlocked. So without further delay, here's Brent Regan. So Brent, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Brent, I wanted to get your take on things, starting with the global and the national situation, right? And I'm going to state a few facts here just to kick everything off. So if you look at the national situation on an economic level, we're over $30 trillion in debt. We have double-digit inflation while two-thirds of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. We're seeing bank failures, especially in the more local and regional banks, which is leading to a consolidation of the financial sector. And finally, we're seeing global de-dollarization with nations making deliberate moves to stop conducting foreign transactions in dollars. And this is happening at a rate that no one ever expected. Then on the geopolitical front, we have an economy which we've outsourced a lot of our productivity to countries like China, and now we're completely dependent on a lot of foreign nations for a lot of the things we need. This is happening at a time when our federal government appears to be escalating a war with Russia, which could lead to World War III, potentially a nuclear confrontation. And then on top of all that, we just had a weapons dump in Afghanistan where we dropped $90 billion worth of military weapons and equipment, which is now being moved all over the world. So that's the geopolitical front. Now on the national front, we have a southern border that's completely open. And I've seen estimates of anywhere from 6 million to 15 million people who've crossed the border in the last 2 years from all over the world. We're seeing drugs pouring in. We're seeing human trafficking at levels that we've never seen before. So the Department of Homeland Security estimates that 85,000 children who've crossed have gone missing into the country. They have some, check-in procedure that they don't follow up. So those kids are now effectively missing. We have a Department of Justice that has been completely corrupted by politics. And our justice system now looks like, a 20th century totalitarian regime. And finally, we have elections in much of the country that have been corrupted. Which many people will think that, the corruption of these elections will ensure that this current regime will stay in place forever. And so that just, scratches the surface. But with all that said, Brent, where would you start in evaluating just the macro situation at the national and the global level?
Wow. Okay. Well, nice weather we're having. I always like to get back to the fundamentals on pretty much everything. I'm an engineer. And so the first question is you ask why, why are things the way they are and how do you fix them from there? And usually there's a low level problem. A while back, I came to the realization that there's this thing I call the prosperity equation, which is labor times energy equals prosperity. How hard you're willing to work and how much energy you have at your disposal equals how much prosperity you're going to experience. I don't care if you're an individual or a business or a country. And so low-cost energy is an essential component to a high degree of prosperity for a given amount of work. And we're seeing with the global warming religion that's going on, that we need, they want expensive sources of energy. They want windmills, which use more energy to build them and deploy them than they create, and solar, which is intermittent. And they refuse to go after the one source, the one real green source, which would solve both the carbon emission problem and the availability problem, which is nuclear. That's the safest source of energy and most reliable source of energy that we have. And they're not talking about nuclear energy. They're talking about these quote-unquote renewable sources, which is code for intermittent. So a lot of the economic problems that we have stem from a non-availability of low-cost energy. Right, and when you can pump energy out of the ground and use it at a relatively low cost, that really stimulates your economy. Since we're not doing that, or we've cut way back on that, and Biden administration on day one said, "Okay, we're not going to be able to move this energy around. We're not going to do it." And of course, the prices go up, and that affects everything.
Right,
you don't go 10 milliseconds in your life without counting on some kind of energy. If you think about it, since the Industrial Revolution, the amount of power that you've got at your disposal is phenomenal. You have, as you know, just waking up and in your bedroom, you have more energy at your disposal than a pharaoh in Egypt did. So having that kind of power available to you means that you can do a lot. It amplifies the work that you do, and it creates prosperity for everyone. So that's, you know, problem one. If you want to solve the economic crisis, one of the first things you have to do is make sure that energy is cheap and abundant. And our fastest way to do that is in the short run is to utilize, you know, some of the cleaner fossil fuels, natural gas, and immediately started a program for fourth and fifth generation nuclear, which is intrinsically safe. And, you know, thorium reactors actually consume what would be nuclear waste from prior reactors. So there are technological solutions there. All we have to do is implement them. And the only thing that's stopping us from having cheap, reliable energy is the Department of Energy.
Yeah, why do you think they're doing that?
Well, I mean, you know, follow the money. We've got, there's a lot of large oil companies that want us to have expensive oil. There's Saudi Arabia that wants us to have expensive oil. All of these guys have lobbyists and they convince other people and who are making laws that they need protection.
Yeah.
You know, skyrocketing fuel costs, it makes the Arab nations smile.
Yeah.
So it makes working class people in America, it's hard for them. But they don't really care.
So when you look at the Idaho economy, I mean, is there potential for Idaho to contribute to the energy production?
Absolutely. I mean, we have the Idaho National Labs. It's one of the gems of the entire country. It's where the thorium reactor systems was originally developed. We could have, I've always said, my fantasy for Idaho is to have five nuclear reactor plants, one on each border with one of the other states, and we sell them all the nuclear power and use the clean, cheap hydro for ourselves.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, we become the Alaska of the lower 48 in that, you know, everybody here gets cheap electricity, if not a check. And then the next evolution of that is to have small scale reactors, modular reactors that can be deployed in communities, you know, or buried in your backyard. And when that happens, now you have a distributed architecture grid, and your grid becomes immune to terrorist attack and EMPs and that sort of thing, because it's not focused on specific power sources and in distributed. There are local sources. And if one area goes down, it doesn't take down the whole state or the whole country. So yeah, it drives me crazy as an engineer and a technologist, knowing that these solutions are at our fingertips and the only thing that's stopping it is politics.
Right. So you're a proponent of the decentralization of the, you know, production of energy down to the local level.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's the only thing that really makes sense. And then, you know, you don't have the transmission losses. It's a far more robust system. It's a distributed architecture. Well, it's the difference between communism and capitalism. Communism uses a centralized architecture where the commissars at the head, you know, decree how many potatoes you're going to grow.
Right.
And they don't let the free market do it. In a distributed architecture, you have all these, you know, self-interested agents who are doing things for their own good, but it ends up being good for everybody.
Right.
And so a distributed architecture is always more robust and more reliable.
But you look at, you know, you look at, and I agree with you, but you look at like World War II, right? That was the rise of, you know, the American corporation, the mass production. We were building all these weapons and shipping them all over the world to support World War II. And then, you know, from that, you had the corporation and economies of scale. And so now what we're seeing today is the consolidation of so many industries. I mean, what do you make of that? Because a lot of Republicans would say, well, that's just the free market, this natural consolidation and centralization of industry.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true to the extent that there are certain things that are economies of scale that will happen. But the other hand is that when you start centralizing, you become calcified and you can't react to market changes. And that was fine, you know, after in the post-war era, you know, the boomer era. Everything was pretty much constant and everybody was more or less aligned and public schools were producing, you know, consumers that all had pretty much the same interests in that. But now we're in an age, the information age, where we have, you know, a lot more diverse interests and new markets and new work categories that are popping up every day. And so these large behemoths can't respond well to that. And as a result, we, you know, we see, well, Kodak. What does Kodak go to do again? Well, they used to be the largest film company on the planet. What do they do now? Not much. Why? Digital cameras. So you have these technologies that come along, and all of a sudden, there's a lot of people that, you know, a company that bought up all the little film companies, and now what can they do? They can't do a damn thing.
Right.
So, you know, and well, the electric car, look at Elon Musk and Tesla, you know, there's something you took the car market, you know, there was the Big Five and Detroit and you'd say there's no way you could break into that. And he's just decimated it, right? Because he brought in interesting new technology and did a good job of it and started with a clean slate. So, yeah, I'm not the whole idea that, oh, they're just going to be these centralized behemoths. And everybody's going to, yeah, that's true. That happens, but it's part of a cycle. And, you know, it's like you grow a giant sequoia. Eventually the thing dies and falls over and you turn the lumber into something useful.
What do you think about, you know, the Trump economic policy, which is, well, so, you know, you go back about 40 years, we started outsourcing, you know, labor to China, you know, cheap labor, right? Labor arbitrage. And we started importing the, you know, since then we've been a much bigger importer than we have been an exporter. What do you think of the, you know, the Trump era policies of, you know, bringing manufacturing back to the United States? Do you think that's a possibility?
Oh, I think it's actually essential. I don't see it as being avoidable because we're going to have geopolitical conflicts, which cause us not to have access to those markets. And there's only so much, you know, fooling around you can do. I was recently reading an article about the development of the SR-71, which was a spy plane, the world's fastest airplane, could fly it, you know, it was 3.5 times the speed of sound. And it was used to spy on Russia at, you know, 60, 70, 80, 100,000 feet. It was built primarily out of titanium, which came from Russia. And so through a series of shell companies and other governments, we were able to buy titanium from Russia to build airplanes that we used to spy on Russia. So, I mean, that kind of stuff can happen, but it can't happen in the kind of scales to sustain entire economies. So, yeah. But America is a remarkably resilient country. And we are resilient because of our diverse nature and can-do attitude. We are a country comprised primarily of people who left other places for a chance to be their own person. You know, you think back at the large migrations that happened, you know, at Ellis Island and that, and even what's going on now. You had people saying, I am going to chance everything. I'm going to take a long journey with a small chance of actually dying, or a reasonable chance of actually dying, in order to go to a place where I can exercise my free will to make something of myself. And we basically drained the world of those people. Yeah. And they all came here and self-selected for that. Now we're benefiting from that. And that's why we won World War II, because there's a bunch of people who said, I don't care what's impossible. I'm going to do it. I'm an inventor, right? And one of the essential elements of inventing is you're doing the impossible. If you create something that has never existed before it existed, it was impossible. So you've got to be either childish enough or arrogant enough to think that you can do something that 7 billion people can't. And that kind of attitude is what's essential for innovation. And in America, we're full of it. You go to other countries and, you go to China or Japan or some South American countries, and they're like, well, it can't be done. Nobody's ever, if it could be done, somebody would have done it by now, is the attitude. And so, you look at Americans and they'll look at something and say, boy, I could do a better job than that. I could make money doing that. I could figure out a way to solve that problem. And so that's the real spirit of America. And, I look at you're talking about our open borders and the immigration that's coming across. Yeah, some of that's bad, right? And I certainly wish that it was regulated. But I'm thinking that the people that are allowing it right now, who think that they're importing voters, they may be in for a surprise. We may find out that a lot of these immigrants that are coming here are actually conservatives, and they would actually align with Republican and conservative values at the end of the day, that they are, religious, God-fearing, family-oriented. Yeah, there's a lot of, single men and people that you don't want showing up, but there's also a lot of people that maybe we do. So, but I'm not advocating for illegal immigration, certainly. There's no reason whatsoever that we can't have a reasonable immigration policy where people can get screened and admitted to folks that we want here and keep out, criminals and bad folks that we don't. And the only thing that's preventing us, again, from doing that is the federal government.
Right. Going back to the economics, you mentioned, we're talking about manufacturing. Where do you see potential? You talked a little bit about the decentralization of energy production in the state of Idaho.
Right.
What other things do you see in terms of the potential of Idaho and contributing to the larger economy?
Well, we've got rare earth metals, our mining resources, our natural resources in is phenomenal in Idaho. There are two basic repositories of the essential rare earth metals, like neodymium and lithium, and they're needed for our modern, electronics and car batteries and such. One is in China and the other is in Idaho.
Right.
And you're thinking, well, what's keeping us from responsibly mining these resources is sitting right underneath our feet. And well, it's the Department of Mines. So, no, we shouldn't be strip mining and we shouldn't be polluting and we shouldn't be dumping lead into the rivers or anything like that. But we have the technology, we have the ability and the facilities to go in and extract these resources that we need. There's really no reason why we shouldn't.
And so how much of that is because the federal government owns, 70% of the land?
63% of Idaho, yeah, is the federal government. They took it when we became a state and they never gave it back, which they should have done. Hmm. And, I don't know how to solve that problem, but they're sitting on a bunch of land that they're basically not paying taxes on. And there is a thing called PILT, payment in lieu of taxes, but it's pennies on the dollar of what that land is worth. And so we don't have equal representation. We can't, as a state, we can't fulfill our potential while the government is squatting on a bunch of our resources. Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't be doing that. And it's not right. It's not moral. And we need to figure out a way to fix it. But you look at the 11 Western states have a huge problem. You go east of the 11 Western states and federal land is just a tiny fraction, 1 or 2%. So it's unique to a minority of the states. And frankly, the payment in lieu of taxes is we're getting money from the other states. They should be pissed about it. They should tell the federal government that, let Idaho manage its own lands.
Right.
And, that falls into the school budget, right? Because under the Idaho Constitution, our public schools are supposed to be funded by revenue from public lands. And since we can't get revenue from our public lands, we don't have the money to fund the school. So there you go. You've got the federal government out of the way, got the lands back, managed that properly, whether it be for timber resources or mining resources or whatever. Now, all of a sudden, you got money for schools.
So timber mining, decentralized energy production, yes. That's what you see as the, the vision.
Absolutely.
For the potential.
Absolutely.
Of Idaho.
I mean, you know, we had at the turn of the last century before, you know, the 1800s, 1900s, there was these huge resources and basically they just went in and gutted it wherever, strip mined and, you know, left a giant mess. Okay. And people came along afterwards and said, well, that's not good. And we all agree, you know, that kind of, but we have the technology now and the responsibility now and the regulations now to do it so that it actually looks better when we're done.
Right.
And there's less of a fire hazard and, you know, managed forests and that. And there's really no reason why we shouldn't be going that way. Right. And it's just, you know, lacking the political will to do it.
Mm-hmm. So I remember to Donald Trump, who's obviously, he's the front runner for the presidential race. He mentioned that he wants to set up some program where, how did he describe it? To, reimagine the Western frontier, the frontier. So, ideas for cities, he would take ideas for new cities that he could set up. Uh-huh. I mean, has there been any thought put into that at the higher levels of politics?
There's unfortunately, with the Agenda 21, now Agenda 2030, there's a lot of, community design that's around the sort of the standard urban development sort of mentality. You know, people who are in the industry of urban development all went to the same urban development schools. And if you go to the downtown in some city, you don't know, recognize what city it is, right? Because it looks like all the other cities with the same little stupid little trees and lollipop trees and public art and all that. And you're wondering, you know, where am I again? I don't see the character of this place. And that's because the designers, are all trained the same and they come out and do that. Now, there is certainly a potential and a possibility to start on a fresh slate and say, let's design an urban center from the ground up. Let's design it as a system and not just a patchwork that was added one thing on top of another, and see how that works. And that might be a good idea. You know, I don't know. Some people might like to live that way, and other people, they prefer to, have to 5 acres and live out in the country a little bit. So, I'm not overly enthusiastic with that model, just because I'm not that kind of person. But I know there's people that love cities and they'd love to be able to, sleep and drive and work within 15 minutes of each other and get their coffee and ride their electric bicycles and do all that. And that's fine.
Well, that's the one thing everyone's afraid of right now, right? Is the 15-minute city where they basically trap us in.
And the idea there is that you just pack people into urban centers, and then now that they're all renters, that they lose touch with what community really is, and they don't have the responsibility. You know, there's the tragedy of the commons, which is, when you take something that doesn't belong to anybody, it's just common property, it turns, and we've seen this in public housing and all kinds of things, where it turns into a cesspool in no time because nobody is responsible for it. You know, when they landed, when the pilgrims first landed here, they had a socialist economy where they say, well, everybody will work as hard as they can, and then you harvest what you can, and they nearly starved to death because why would you work harder than the next guy when he's going to get your share? And so the next year, the governor of the pilgrim said, well, hey, we're going to set it up so that everybody's responsible for their own. And sure enough, production went way up. So having a city where nobody is really responsible for, nobody owns the property, you're living in a space you don't own, I see that as, people not wanting to improve it, not wanting to have that resource. One of the great things that has really turned the world around from a poverty standpoint, I think it was in the 80s, what was it? There was 1 in 4 people was living below the poverty line, dollar a day kind of poverty, grinding poverty. So 25%. And that's been cut down to I think about 4% now. And the reason is because of property rights, basically. If you own something and you know that you own it, you can prove that you own it, then you can loan money against it. And you can use that money to start a business or to make improvements or to increase your wealth that way. And so having property rights is critical to building an economy. Having individual property rights is critical. So anything that steps in the way of that, you're asking for trouble in the long run. You know, not to say that you can't have, you know, a 15-minute city for people who want to live in 15-minute cities, but that certainly isn't every city. And it shouldn't be. We need the diversity. We need the different people in different kind of environments to look at things different ways so that you can arrive at a good solution. If everybody's the same, you know, the single problem can kill everyone. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's you lack that resiliency that you need.
Do you ever worry that the people who run politics in the United States today and who run, you have a lot of influence at the global level. Do you ever worry that they will succeed in bringing down these things that we're talking about, like property rights and, you know, making it, like, for example, Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum says, you know, for the model of the future is you will own nothing and you'll be happy. Do you ever worry that they'll succeed in that vision?
Well, I mean, they may succeed in part, but it's unsustainable in total. So the only question is it going to fail soon enough to recover or not? You know, it's not socialism has been the experiment that everybody says, well, it's going to work next time.
Right.
And no matter how many times it fails, you get these people to stand up. Well, we just didn't do it right. You know, and they don't admit that intrinsically it can't work. And so Charles Schwab saying, well, you're going to be happy because you won't own anything. Well, who does own it then? Somebody's got to own it. Right. So what he's saying is that we want to have two classes of people, the owners and the non-owners. And now all of a sudden you're back to having, kings and serfs.
Right.
And that's the model, right?
Well, yeah, they talk about it openly too. I mean, you go back and read Carol Quigley, right? They talk about moving to this neo-feudalist model of society. And it's, you know, they're pretty open about it, which is incredible.
Well, and, you know, if you destroy the education system so people are stupid and they don't know how to get out of the situation that they're in, and then they're stuck, right? And then you have these people and they're basically cattle.
Yeah.
So, and I certainly don't support that, but, and I'm going to be a wolf. There may be people out there that are sheep. I'll be a sheepdog or a wolf, you know, and, I'm going to train whoever wants to follow my footsteps, I'll help them along. Right. But, no, I'm not a big fan of dumbing people down. The smarter the population, you get more. It's far more interesting. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, totally. So moving on to, you know, politics at the state level, just would love to get your general idea or your general view of how things are going. You know, I painted that grim picture of things that are happening at the national level. How do you look at the state of Idaho and the current politics and how that, you know, interacts with politics at the national level?
Well, right now, the state of Idaho is going under this very interesting dynamic. You know, 40 years ago, Idaho was predominantly a Democrat state. And then in the intervening years, it became more and more and more Republican. But there's a lot of people in the bureaucracy who said, well, Democrat isn't working out for me. I'll be a Republican instead. And they didn't really adopt the principles of Republicanism, right? They didn't follow the platform. They didn't adhere to the platform or believe in the platform. And so as a result, you've got a people who say they're Republicans, and, you know, it's a tired old term, Republican in name only, but you have Republicans who really are more aligned with a liberal mentality. And by liberal, I mean progressive, not classic liberal. And that, you know, they think the government is good and bigger government is better. And you know, some of them are nice people that just want to help, and you give them a tool of government, and they're going to say, well, I'm going to deploy this to fix everything. You know, he's got a hammer and everything looks like a nail. But now we've seen a kind of a rising of the grassroots, the voters, the average voter. And they're saying, wait a minute, you say you're a Republican, but I don't really believe that. Mm-hmm. And there has been a general shift to a more conservative legislature, more conservative politicians.
Yes,
you have the what has been the leadership of Idaho saying all of a sudden, wait a minute, we don't like what's going on here because we're not, you know, we're being challenged. We're having long-term incumbents. People are coming along and saying, no, I'm we want the other guy. That just happened with the attorney general race, right? Lawrence Wasdin basically grew up in that office. He was in that office for 30 years and eventually became the attorney general and was there, you know, forever. And then Raul Labrador came along and beat him 70-30,
right?
You know, shockingly. And that was the polling 3 months before the election told us that that was going to happen. So it's pretty remarkable. And that's made a lot of people nervous. And then just now at our last Republican Party convention, there was a big shift in leadership. It went from what would you'd call establishment to grassroots, and not by a few votes. It was 140 vote margin out of like 700 total. That it shifted from Tom Luna and sort of the establishment group to Dorothy Moon and the grassroots group. So that that change is happening as we speak. Some of that I think is attributed to the Idaho Freedom Foundation. Back 10 years ago, the Freedom Index was started, and what the Freedom Index does is it has 12 metrics, 12 things that a bill is measured on. Does it increase spending? Does it increase government? Does it create a new government agency? Does it create a new regulation? Okay, yes or no. And those are simple questions to answer when you read the bill. It doesn't require a lot of judgment. You just go through and say, does it do this? Does it do that? And you read it, and yes, it does, or no, it doesn't. That gives it a score. And then when a legislator votes yes or no on that bill, they get that score, up or down. And so at the end of the legislative session, you add up all the scores, and all of a sudden you know which legislators always vote for bigger government, more regulation, higher taxes, you know, more spending, and which ones vote the other way, you know, lower taxes. And because they all say they're conservative, right? They all say, and I remember 10 years ago, there was a Representative Broadsword from Sandpoint. I said, oh yeah, no, I'm a solid Republican. She had a more liberal voting record than all the Democrats. She was the absolute bottom of the list. And when the Freedom Index came out, and this, you know, couple cycles of Freedom Index, people, wait a minute, you aren't what you, you know, had, she goes home, oh yeah, I'm a conservative Republican. It goes down and votes the other way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people being held accountable for what they actually do as opposed to what they say, I think has had a big influence on that.
Yeah. So when you talk about, you know, bigger government, you know, versus smaller government and the Freedom Index, and you look at, you know, government at the local level and in the state level, but we live in a day and age where a lot of these big businesses, especially the big financial firms, right, like BlackRock, they're working hand in hand with the left wing that's in the government mm-hmm. right now. So what do you say at that point? Like, let's say BlackRock wanted to come in and buy up a bunch of residential properties in Coeur d'Alene, right? I mean, what do you do at that point? Where do you balance, where do you draw the line between, okay, we're just going to let the free market work versus actually, no, this isn't going to be good for the community?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a real problem, because if you got somebody that walks in, how would you stop something like that? You know, well, BlackRock can't buy. Well, now BlackRock has, all they have to do is fraction off, you know, 60 or 70 or 3,000 little LLC corporations that come in and you know, have representatives that buy it up. And so the question is, if you do that, what are you going to do with it, right?
Yeah.
How are you going to make money at it? And if you end up buying up everything, then, you know, there's no real market that you're competing in, and there's no real way to make money. And all of a sudden that market collapses and you lose all your money.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not that worried about BlackRock doing that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a real catch 22. You live in a nice place, other people want to live there too. If it's cheap to live in a nice place, other people really want to live there. And as soon as they come, then prices go up and it's no longer cheap.
Right.
So if you don't want people to live in your neighborhood, then, you know, you can turn it into a bad neighborhood, or you simply, you know, endure.
Right.
But you know, that's the problem of living in one of the nicest places in the country. Don't tell anybody I said that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, remember all those, the needles down on the beach and the human waste on the streets and all that. It's horrible yeah. in downtown Gardelaine. Yeah, you don't want to come here.
Yeah. Yeah. Horrible place to visit.
That's right. Sure. That's right. If you don't get mugged or killed on the way from the airport. Yeah.
That's totally.
Wink, wink, nod, nod.
Yeah. Yeah. North Idaho really is just the hidden gem. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, so you talk about, you know, the grassroots and, you know, what kind of, you know, what kind of progress are you seeing? So we've got, you know, the Attorney General, you know, the Republican, the state committee and the Republican Party has, you know, has gone to the grassroots. You know, what kind of agenda are they implementing and what kind of success are you seeing with these victories?
Well, you know, it isn't so much as an agenda as an attitude. You know, if you get people in there that really do see with the reality of it, that government and taxation is a giant damper. Okay. It is a load that puts on the economy and the people. If you, I remember 4 or 5 years ago, I read a study and actually did a little research on this about how if we had less government, you know, that we would actually end up with more government. And the way that works is that if you have less government, then your economy grows a lot faster. You know, the economy grows on the marginal profit. So it takes a certain amount to operate, and then the few percent, 3 or 4 or 5% that's left over. And if you take half of that out in taxes, you know, we're going to tax your profits by 40%. Then your ability to grow is cut by 40%.
Right.
Okay. So you can't become a larger, more prosperous thing. So government actually taxed less. In the long run, the revenues would be much higher,
right?
Because they'd be taxing less of a much larger thing. And but our politicians see taxation not as a way for revenue and in order to run the government. They see it as a way of social control. And so, you know, you get outsized taxes on some things and not, you know, liquor tax or sin tax or luxury tax, or, well, we've got too much of this carbon tax, and so we're going to fix it by applying more tax to it. And what you're really doing is saying, well, we're going to ratchet down the growth of the economy. And it's the growth of the economy that counters inflation, right? Because we live in a society where we have fractionally reserved banking. If everything was static, prices were static, money was static, and banks lent money at a given percentage, eventually the banks end up with all the money. You know, that's just a fixed game, if you will, because they lend it out at a fixed percentage rate. And they get the money that was out there plus a little more each time, which means that the pool of money that's in the hands of the people is a little less, and sooner or later the banks have on them. So the way out of that is that you grow the economy and you have inflation, right? Mm-hmm. So that the dollars become worth less, and they're being generated in the private sector and then being consumed. So that whole system requires some sort of balance to it. So, right. You know, a certain level of inflation is necessary because it's necessary to balance off the interest rates that we're paying to borrow money from the lending institutions.
Right.
So, you know, that's something that we can deal with rationally. But if we have people in government that understand basic economics, they understand what's going on, then when they're making decisions about policies, there's a higher probability they're going to do something that doesn't hurt as bad. Yeah. So,
you know, I always love the statistics. So our taxes, I think in normal years, it was 20%. The government borrows the rest of what it spends, either borrows or prints it.
Right.
And then 20% 20% of it are our taxes, but that has gone down in recent years. So really the whole point of at this point, they borrow so much and they print so much that what's the point of even taxing? Well, they do it, as you said, social control, to clamp down, to take away our freedoms.
Right. Say that, you know, we're paying our income taxes in order to run the government when the government's printing their own money to run the government. So, you know, why are you paying them?
Yeah.
That's, and you know, income taxes always aggravates me because it's based on the assumption that you're worth nothing. In other words, if I go and pay an employee to do something as a businessman, I can deduct what I pay that employee from my income, you know, to lower my taxes. But if you give the most precious thing you have, which is your time, to a job, you don't get any credit for that, you know, and you're taxed on the absolute dollars that you receive, and you're not allowed credits for the expenses that it takes to, you know, to house you and feed you and keep you happy and entertained and healthy in order to do that. So it's that whole system fundamentally is based on the government assuming that you're worth nothing.
Right.
And I, you know, I object to that.
Right. Yeah. I object to the fact that I work 4 months a year just to pay the federal government. Yeah. And for what? Right.
Well, there's a name for that. And I believe it was outlawed in the 13th Amendment.
Yeah. Right.
Working for free.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So going back, I mean, you know, one of the things that's on people's mind is elections, election integrity. How do you view election integrity in the state of Idaho?
Well, election integrity is entirely a function of the integrity of the people that run the election, okay? The system is designed not to really be auditable, okay? We learned from the Durham report that lots of the three-letter agencies are corrupt. We know that the media is telling you lies. We know that almost every function of government has some level of corruption. Thankfully, we also know that in all 50 states, the election systems are perfect.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, in order to have confidence in our local elections in Kootenai County, I actually went down and volunteered and studied the election system. And I've done pretty much every job there is to do in the elections department and the elections office. And I watched it firsthand. And I sleep well knowing that the Kootenai County elections office is run by honest people with good integrity and they're doing a good job at it. And I, you know, I don't have to worry about that. What that tells me, though, is we have a system which is utterly dependent on the integrity of the people that are running it. You get a couple of schlubs in some other state or some other county, and they decide they're going to cheat. It's pretty easy. And I can tell you, one of the jobs I did was we were taking ballots from overseas, which can come in on like fax paper, and then converting them to a ballot that a machine could read. Okay. And that was a three-panel board. One person took the original ballot and read it off, who voted for what. And then another person was at a machine punching in the same machines they use for handicapped or blind people to punch in the right. Okay. And then that person would read it off and they'd hand the original ballot to the third person and they would verify that what was put in the machine and printed out on the ballot from the machine was the same as the ballot that was originally sent in. Okay. And I was sitting there reading it off and, you know, there's people around and I'm thinking, and there was one that came in and there was no vote for president. And for half a millisecond, I thought, it'd be really easy just to fill in my guy, right? And then, you know, the little devil pops up on your shoulder go ahead and do it, right? And the angel, no, don't do that. And I, at that moment, I had a bit of an epiphany. I said, man, this would, you get two people and it'd be real easy, right? So we need election systems that are closely monitored. We need to not have machines that are proprietary in their software that you can't audit. By law, you can't look inside them in order to make sure that we have confidence in that. And back January 2nd, I think it was 2020, we put together a committee to come up with 14 or standards for election integrity. The government loves standards, right? I fly an airplane and you take a little stupid little washer. Right? Little washer. There is a sheet of paper somewhere that tells you everything you need to know about that washer. Its thickness, its material, its surface finish, its coating, its dimensions, everything. Okay? Government loves standards. So why don't we have standards for elections? In other words, Idaho, do elections any way you want, but the result has to meet these standards. Okay. We have to be sure that you've got photo ID. So the people that are voting, we know are voting. We have to have a paper ballot train so that we know that we can go back and audit it and count those ballots. So we have to. And the solution that we came up with for these electronic tabulation machines is to have all the ballots tabulated by two separate systems. Okay. So you got company A tabulates the machine, and then you come over to this other system. And company B, or it's open source, or you had some college develop it, or there's hand cut, whatever, just two separate systems. And then you compare the totals from the two systems. Now, if you got one system that's got, tabulating machines and there's some hocus pocus going on with the software, it won't match the other one. Okay. So if the two don't match within some small percentage, you say, okay, we got a problem. Now we got to do a hand count or something like that. If they do match, then you say, okay, I can trust the two systems, even though I don't know what's in them. They're black boxes, say. Right. But because they produce the same results using two different ways of going at it, then you can have a high degree of confidence that the answer is close to correct. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the ideas we came up with. There were these 14 points, and we did that prior to the January 6th events because we wanted our congressional members, Russ Vulture and Simpson, and Crapo and Riche, we wanted them to have these standards handy. So they said, well, I don't think that your election was right. Here are some standards that we have, and this is how it should be done, mm-hmm. right? They had at least some tool at their disposal that they could use. And those standards were actually read in the congressional record in both the House and the Senate. Now, there hasn't been a lot of action on them since, but there is out there a pretty clear way of how we can ensure election integrity without going in and messing with the laws of individual states, but saying, hey, legislatures, since you're responsible for conducting an election, here are some standards. If you want to have a fair and honest election, make sure that the laws you have comport with these standards. And if they do, that's going to increase voter confidence. And we're going to have a lot less of this, screaming and yelling after an election.
So Representative Alfieri, he said in the People's Pen, he was talking about how the Secretary of State just increased its budget by $10 million mm-hmm. to implement new software and hardware, election machines, essentially.
Yeah.
And the requirements have yet to be defined. I mean, when you hear something like that, what goes through your mind?
Oh, boy. Again, if you've got one system, one company, one guy doing one everything, you got a problem. Right? Because there's no way it's proprietary software. I know that Phil Hart wanted to have a law that says that all the software used is open source. Well, that's okay. You can have open source software if you know how to read code and you can read, everything that goes on in it. And there's not a lot of people that can do that. That's why I like the two systems approach.
Right.
And then you can verify, what's going on right then and there by having, two different ways of tabulating it. To give you an idea, we were brainstorming, a bunch of geeks were, myself being among them, we're sitting around talking, well, how would this look? And I said, well, imagine this, okay? You go into your voting place and you fill out your ballot. And after you're done, you walk up to the ballot box and you slide it in the slot. Well, right above the ballot box is this machine with these curtains on either side, so only you can see it. And you drop your ballot into that slot first, okay? And it reads your ballot and puts up on the screen who you voted for. And there's two buttons, accept or reject, okay? And if you look at who you voted for, yeah, that's who I voted for. That's how it counted. That's tabulation. I accept it. Boom. And the ballot drops into the ballot box. You push the reject button and it dumps out back in the front and you pick it up and say, I'd like a new ballot. This one is spoiled. And you fill out another one and repeat the process. So now you have basically witnessed the tabulation of your ballot right in front of you. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now that at the precinct level, you've got a tabulation of all the votes. So at 8 o'clock, all the precinct judges can say, phone in or send in or send their counts in from each of the precincts. So now you've got a count from each of the precincts. Now all those ballots go back to the central office on 3rd Street in Kootenai County, and they run through the big tabulators. Okay. And they better match.
Right.
Or else you've got a problem. But that's a way where you could do it very simply with, you know, a couple $1,000s worth of hardware at each of the 70 precincts, mm-hmm. you know, less than $250,000 probably you could implement in the whole county. And you would have assurance that you voted for who you voted for. There's confirmation right there. Mm-hmm. And then, yep, that's who I did. And nobody else would know it was you, right? And it would just, like, inside the counter would count and say, okay, tabulate these votes, but it wouldn't know which ballot it tabulated it from. And then at the end of the night, those results get reported, and bing, now at 8:05, we have our preliminary election count, and then it gets tabulated in the office again, and then it gets canvassed, so you got a triple check. So a system like that is, you know, I keep talking to clerks, and oh, there's no way you can implement that. And as an engineer, I'm thinking, of course you can do it. Yeah. It's simple. You know, it's a, what does a scanner cost? You know, almost every printer out there, $100 printer has a scanner.
Yeah.
You know, you could take a picture with a cell phone and write software. The cell phone could identify who you voted for, right? Take the image and convert it into tabulated votes and display that on a screen. Mm. And there you go. So the technology is right there.
Yeah.
And a way to do it is right there. And we just need people to, you know, to wake up and understand it can be done. Maybe we need to do a demonstration on it. Maybe we'd have a contest, you know, we'd go, okay, colleges out there, we're going to give $1 million prize to anybody who can come up with a, you know, a tabulating system that can work in the precincts and cost less than $2,000 per, you know, per system.
Right.
Or something like that. And open source and, you know, whatever, because it's a, it'd be a trivial thing to do. And you don't have to worry about it being hacked because you counted another way with another system.
Right.
And that could be the official, you know, expensive, you know, Dominion machine or whatever that all the clerks like, you know? So there you go.
Yeah. Okay.
See, I'm a solutions kind of guy.
Yeah. No, yeah, totally. Yeah. So just, you're wrapping things up here. So right now you're, chairman of the Kootenai County Republican Party. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you see for the future? I mean, you're running for office. I mean, what are your thoughts?
My personal thoughts?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, no. No, I have no aspirations for any kind of higher office. I'm, you know, the only reason I like doing what I'm doing in the Central Committee is because basically I'm able to apply management skills that I learned in, you know, running businesses to politics, and it seems to be effective. What people don't understand, I get accused, oh, he's a dictator, or he's got a cult, or he's got a, you know, everything, you got to kiss the ring or whatever. And that's exactly the opposite of what's going on. The reason is because people who know conservative Republicans know that they are self-motivating type A personalities who are competent and capable and smart. But the one thing they hate is to be told how to do something or told what to do, or you got to do it my way. That won't bring an organization together at all. So, you know, I'm an engineer and a machinist and a mechanic, and I got a big toolbox full of, you know, all kinds of tools. And when I need to do a specific task, I know that there's a specific tool that I can go find in my toolbox that's just right for that job. Okay. People are a lot like that, in that you have certain people that are really good at certain things. And so as chairman, my job is to try and identify what people are good at and then applying them to that problem. And if you get the right person doing the right thing, you don't have to tell them anything. You just stand back and let them run. And we've been able to do that on our committee. We've got just a dynamite team. And it's because you give them the not only the responsibility, but the authority. You know, I tell the story that we had a lady who wanted to be the chairman of the parade. And she came to me and she said, you know, I really want to do this, 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 and this on the parade. You know, I want to do this, build a Trump train and do all this stuff. And I said, and she said, well, can I do that? And I said, I looked at her, I said, I don't know, can you? And she says, well, don't I need permission? I said, no, you're the chairman. You decide. She said, I can? I said, yes. And she came up with this Trump train parade float that was the absolute hit of the parade. And other counties wanted to borrow it after that. Yeah. They came to us and said, "Oh, can we please use it? It was so nice." So, you know, the secret is, and it's not much of a secret, but the secret is you get good people, you give them the authority, you give them the latitude, you give them the responsibility, and then you give them the credit.
Right.
And you stand back and watch it happen.
Yeah.
And that's, and that, then that breeds success. The success attracts other people because they know that it attracts not only people that want to help out and be involved, but it attracts candidates who say, you know, if I'm working with you guys, then I can also, you know, if I want to be in public office or if I want to do that kind of thing, then this is the right place to be because these people are going to help me do it and facilitate that and make sure it happens. And that's a secret. We've had groups, you know, there's, God, 12 or 15 different Republican groups, conservative groups in the area. And we've had groups that have kind of sprouted up and around one charismatic guy or, you know, one idea or something. And they say, okay, we're all going to do things this way. And that lasts maybe 2 or 3 years. And then people say, well, I know how to do it. You don't have to tell me how to do that. I'm not, you know, and then they get excommunicated and yeah. You know, the organization falls apart. So that's a lesson. And it's difficult for me. Because I'm a get in there and hands-on fix it kind of guy. You know, I love solving problems and I love fixing things. I love, you know, repairing old stuff and restoring things. And, you know, so I see a problem, I go, oh, I can fix it. And then I have to check myself and say, no, we've got a chairman or a committee or somebody who is, that's their responsibility. So I'll go to them and say, hey, can we get this fixed? Mm-hmm. Let me know if you need help.
Yeah. It reminds me of in the Marine Corps, I had this commanding officer and before he left, he gave his whole philosophy on work as, you know, running the regiment. He said, what did he say? He said he called it the art of loafing, like, you know, tongue in cheek, joking. But, you know, what he said, he's like, you know, sometimes you might find me sleeping under my desk, but the reason is that you have to let people do their jobs. And yeah, but it was this whole joke. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of truth to that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I the way I put it is I work very hard at being lazy.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. That was his whole philosophy.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, there's merit to that because then that means that other people don't, you know, don't depend on you. Everything doesn't seize when you don't make a decision, that people have autonomy and you know, you just, and if they don't do it exactly your way, sometimes you gotta, oh well, yeah, fine, good. Mm-hmm. You know, good job, get on with it, you yeah. know. Because that's having somebody else get it 99% right is better than you doing it and having it be 100%. You know?
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. So wrapping it up here. So what do you want to part on the audience? I know a lot of people are feeling down about the way things are going in the country right now. And you know, any final thoughts? Any last message you'd say?
Yeah. Years ago. I remember listening to a story about a guy who was an investment banker, and he wanted to capture the coffee market. He thought that there are coffee futures, and so he sent some folks down to Brazil, and they said, "I want you to study the coffee market down there, and so that we know ahead of time what the market's going to do, and then we'll be able to make a move on the stock market and make a killing." So he sent these guys down there. And they came back with reports, oh, it's horrible. There was a flood. There was some disease. Half the crop died. There's a labor strike. There's a dock strike. There's this, that. And, you know, it's terrible. And so they, you know, they got this news. Okay, this is great because, you know, prices are going to go way up. And they went long on all this, on their investments. And the announcements came out. The production numbers came out. And it was pretty much the same as last year. And then what the heck is going on? Well, every year. There's a flood, and every year there's a disease, and every year there's a strike, and every year there's something horrible happens. And so, you know, the lesson you get from that is, yeah, we see a lot of heartache and strife and, you know, danger on the horizon. And then you think back to our founding fathers, right? and the 53 of them that signed the Declaration of Independence and what they went through and what they sacrificed. Many of them died. Many of them were left penniless. You know, their lives, their sacred honor, their fortunes. And you think, okay, they did that. And what am I risking here exactly? What's going on for me? You know, I'm still going to have my air conditioning. I'm still going to have enough food to eat, you know? So I say it may look dire, but we're tough.
Yeah.
And we're resilient and we're freaking Americans and we're going to be okay at the end of the day as long as we stick together. And I told the committee this the other night. I said, it's Franklin. Either we hang together or surely we will hang separately. So, I'm frustrated. I'm pissed. I'm angry at you know, the federal agencies that are, they're not obeying the Constitution, that they're corrupt, that you got politics, they're playing politics where they shouldn't be. And yeah, that's that. There's going to be a reckoning there. But at the end of the day, I'd rather be here than anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Brent, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time, and it was great talking to you.
Well, it's been fun. I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Excellent.
Do you have something to say? Interested in learning more about publishing on the Idaho Speaks Network? Our nation was built on ideas, and your idea could be the next political advancement for Idaho. Call Ed at 208-209-7170 or email hello@idahospeaks.com to start the conversation. We've reached the end of the episode, but not the end of the issue. Please share this episode with your friends and family. If you have questions or would like to share your own issues and ideas, visit www.idahospeaks.com and click Share an Issue. Your state, your voice, Idaho Speaks.